Once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome to another sort of semi, almost kind of exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jake McClure. And on the line with me, I have
Jeff McClure.
This is the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got some disclosures to throw out there in the middle of this because we'll be talking about the economy, and you cannot talk about the economy without telling everyone not to believe a word that you say or something to that effect. Now, that's a disclaimer. That's not a disclosure, is it?
Yeah, you're right. It is a disclaimer. We do disclaimers, too.
Yeah, that whole thing about disclaiming and not warranting or guaranteeing any of the information that we talk about.
Right.
That's a disclaimer. That's us saying we're getting our information from places we think are right, but don't hold us to it.
Deem.
We deem are right. Yes. You got to use the right word here. Deeming. All right. So then we have the Personal Wealth Coach is not just a radio program. That's the name of this program, but it's also not coincidentally the name of an investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that's registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. That isn't to say that they approve anything about what the firm says or does, but it does say that that's who regulates the firm. Now, that firm and this radio program have a lot in common, namely two bald guys with beards, one with a white beard and one with a darker beard that's sort of getting white as well. And that is that the two principals of that investment advisory firm are the two co-hosts of this radio program. But what we do at the firm as investment advice is fiduciary. And that means that it's got to be in the best interest of the client. And what we do on the radio program cannot be. Wish it could be, but we, in order to be a fiduciary, you actually have to know the people that you're talking to. And I don't think we know everybody we're talking to right now. Do you?
Well, a lot of times I don't know if people are actually listening. It could be that so few people are listening, it doesn't make any difference.
It could be that we know everyone that's listening, but the ratings say otherwise. So what we're offering on the radio is educational in nature, hopefully to make you make better decisions about your finances, about what you should and should not be worried about in the market these days. All right. So do you have anything else to add to that?
Well, you didn't use my favorite term, so that's okay.
Yeah, I didn't. I used the disclaimer word, and I didn't say deem the first time around. I didn't say warranty or guarantee.
Yeah, but those are great words. I don't get to use them, but I only get to use them once a week. And they're in the dictionary.
They're on the bottom of every single one of the emails that you send out.
No, the deem, the warranty, I don't think so. I don't think we have deem in the email. And I don't get to use deem once a week. Could be we do, though. You know better than I do. Anyway, the point is that we're trying to be educational and we're trying to be entertaining a little bit about
what?
About the business science.
Yes. Yes. Entertainment might be had on cartoons on a Saturday morning or by listening to two bald nerds talk about the economy.
Yeah, that's it.
So we're going to do our best to entertain you in our typically economist fashion. Ready? Start the tap dance. That is a normal part of the economic world, is the tap dance when you get your predictions incorrect. Do you want to talk about what happened in the market this week?
Well, the S&P 500 stock index, which is the index that we use to figure out what's going on in the market. And I want to emphasize something here that I don't normally talk about. It's one of the great secrets of the S&P 500 index.
Do you have to whisper while you're telling it?
Well, I don't know. I could. The point is that the S&P 500 index is not a very good index in many ways, although it's the best one that's widely published. You have a choice between Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is 30 stocks, chosen by somebody at Dow Jones and Company, which is now
owned by the same people that own S&P,
which is owned by somebody else. I don't remember who owns it now. Anyway, they pick 30 stocks. I think the editors of the Wall Street Journal still get to pick the 30 stocks. And when you have a stock market that has thousands of stocks in it, and the New York Stock Exchange alone, picking 30 stocks and saying, here's what's going on in the economy, is kind of a shot in the dark. They've done a pretty good job, but we either have that 30 stocks or we have 500. And the 500 stocks in the S&P 500 stock index are weighted in the index according to how much their total share value is of all the shares outstanding, which leads to some distortion, but it's a distortion that everybody agrees is the standard distortion, so we'll use it. The S&P 500 stock index, which is the measure that we use for the U.S. stock market, sagged 0.77% for the week ending November 20th, Friday. Closed at 35.57.54. Now, why is that important? Well, you multiply that times 52 and it becomes something significant. And the other thing is, we've had virus vaccines popping up. Some relatively good news in the market, in the economy, and the Standard & Poor's 500 sagged down from its previous record. And the editors, not the editors, but the reporters from the Wall Street Journal credited it to the fact that the Secretary of the Treasury announced that as of December 31st, an emergency lending facility that the Treasury has, which actually is run through the Federal Reserve, is going to shut down. An emergency lending is for companies, relatively small companies, not tiny companies, but small companies that needed the money to keep going through the end of the coronavirus pandemic. And he turned the money, he demanded the money back from the Fed, who, by the way, paid him the money back.
He agreed to. That'll be at the end of the year when the lending program expires.
Yeah, agreed to pay him back. And he's going to, today he announced he's going to turn it over to the Senate, to the Congress to act so they can include it in the stimulus bill. But there is no evidence that there's any progress on the stimulus bill, which is kind of depressing in the market. And the fact that we have had record-breaking resurgence of COVID-19 across the country. The other thing is the S&P 500 is up 10.11% as we approach the end of the year, which is a
10%. Nice.
Which is really, really nice. It's down about 0.65% from its high at the beginning of September. You would think September through December, with virus vaccines coming out and everything looking pretty good, it would continue to go up, but of course it didn't. The market does the same thing. The other thing that's going on, and it's a slow rotation, is a rotation from the large cap growth stocks, like, for instance, Microsoft and Apple, and what are the others? Alphabet.
Tesla. Although Tesla just had a big bump up because they got included in the S&P 500.
The market is gradually pulling down, very, very gradually pulling down on those stocks and going back to smaller stocks that are value-oriented rather than growth-oriented, which is something that we find very positive because historically when growth stocks, the ones that are priced based on their projected future growth for the next 100 years or so, start to rise way above the rest of the market, it has never ended very nicely in the history of the market.
Yeah.
If we get a slow rotation back to value stocks, which are stocks that are priced below their intrinsic value of the company, that's generally healthy for the market. So we get about a 1% differential. The broad stock market.
We're getting really technical there. Let's explain that. And companies that are valued based on what they own minus what they owe, like a net worth. A book value is what it's called, or a total equity. If the market's price for them, if you add all their shares together and multiply by the share price, is around that amount, that's called a value company. And if the market's valuing them less than their net worth, if they go bankrupt, then the market owners, the ones that are owning the shares of that company, could actually make a profit. Now, a growth company is valued on its expected earnings. And right now, the growth companies for the past, throughout the pandemic, since the crash at the beginning of the pandemic, growth companies have been valued on expected earnings that go exponentially higher forever into the future. And so we've got a bubble going on that end. And what you're saying is that we're seeing that switch. And you also just said, this is all interpretation, by the way, I'm interpreting economic ease into plain American English. We've been seeing a slow shift back away from the bubble and back toward the underpriced but very, very good companies that are in the stock market. It's not done. There's still a big bubble on the growth end, but it's coming back down to reasonability. At some point, we might see a bigger transfer, and that will probably amount to a drop in the S&P 500. And I would even say, I'm going to go out on a limb here. Do you mind if I go out on a limb?
Well, it all depends on how big the limb is.
It's a fairly thin limb, actually. We usually go out on really broad limbs that we very small chance of being wrong on. I'm actually going to be jumping out on a thin limb. And that is that I think that we may see a downturn in the market when the news is announced that the vaccine is actually out. Not its efficacy, not its approval rating or any of that, but when the vaccine actually hits, people will realize that you can't stay in these growth companies forever expecting their earnings to go up with the pandemic keeping people shut in their homes.
Yeah, a lot of the growth companies that have risen so fast, and by the way, William's already taken a hit that soon, are based on an economy where a lot of people are staying home and not going to be in presence of other people. You know, Amazon is probably the king of that paradigm. And to think that Amazon people will continue to order everything from Amazon rather than going to the hardware store or going to the clothing store is probably not really good thinking. But the market is priced for Amazon, for example, to continue to grow as fast as it's growing this year for the next 10 years. And Amazon probably won't grow for the next 10 years at the same rate that it's grown recently because, very simply, people will want to go. For instance, I personally have ordered things from Amazon that historically I would go to the hardware store and get. But since I don't want to go into the hardware store where there's a lot of people and shop around to try to find whatever it is that I want to find and then bring it back out of there and be next to the cashier and next to other people, I've ordered it from Amazon.
Can we come out and say this, that socially the two of us have been close to hermits our entire life, so there's some degree of pleasure in being forced not to deal with people?
Well, yeah, but I love to go to the hardware store. That's the equivalent of going to the toy store for me and wander around and look at things. And when this pandemic is, when I get a vaccination and I'm convinced that I have a very low probability of getting COVID-19 from somebody, I probably will go back to the hardware store rather than ordering everything from Amazon. And I'm just, everybody else might continue to order everything from Amazon, but I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
And above all, the market is priced right now based on the growth in that area, not just on the fact that people will continue to use Amazon.
Right.
Use an example, nothing against Amazon or for Amazon.
Well, let's say here, there is something big for Amazon. We both love Amazon. We buy a bunch of stuff from Amazon, but we would not own Amazon right now. So there you go.
Well, if I could own a whole company, I think I'd take it.
Yeah, I think that'd be worthwhile if you could just have the whole thing. Yeah, especially if you didn't have to pay for it. But
my name is not Warren Buffett, so I can't do that.
He just nor Jeff Bezos.
Well, he gets, you know, Warren Buffett's good. He gets to buy entire companies with somebody else's money.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I like that. Anyway, that's going to change. The economy has had turned upside down in many ways because of the pandemic. But the pandemic, contrary to popular belief, will not go on forever. And the pandemic is getting a lot worse. Even though you may not see it personally, we've had a double in about less than a month. We've doubled the number of people in hospital. for COVID-19.
You sounded very British there. You said in hospital instead of in the hospital. Yeah.
I realize that I have been reading too much from The Economist and Financial Times. I left the V off of hospital. Like, it's just kind of strange because we say the hospital like there's only one.
Right. Let's go to the hospital. Well, which one? The hospital.
In the hospital, whereas in Britain, in where they actually speak English, they say he's in hospital or he's in university or she's in university to be properly non-sexist. Anyway, the U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index, and I use the CRSP U.S. Mid-Cap Value Index because it's a good one, rose 0.42% for the week. And why do I say that? Why that's important? The S&P 500, which is loaded towards large growth companies, went down about 0.77% for the week, whereas mid-cap value, which is smaller companies, mid-sized companies that are based on value based on, rather than growth, rose 0.42%. That's a good sign that we've got a rotation going on. Now, let me tell you, that mid-cap value has got a long ways to go to catch up with the S&P 500, but eventually they'll meet in the middle, I think, historically. They've done that. And the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury note said the bond market was unhappy about something. It fell to 0.829%. Now, I want you to think about that just a minute. If you, the standard, that's the standard baseline rate for loans in the United States, if you, because the government is the most credible borrower of money. And if you bought a 10-year U.S. Treasury right now, straight from the Federal Reserve or straight from the Dallas Federal Reserve Bank or wherever you bought it from, paid no commissions or anything else, it would pay you 0.892% a year.
Right, 8.29%.
0.829% per year. Less than 1% a year, whereas inflation is running about 1.2%, 1.3%, 1.4% right now. You basically, the people who are buying U.S. Treasuries, and there are a lot of people buying U.S. Treasuries, there's a lot of governments buying U.S. Treasuries, know that the dollar, the inflation on the dollar over the next 10 years will almost certainly exceed the interest rate they're getting on their 10-year Treasury note, which means they're buying at a negative yield, which tells you a lot about what's going on in bonds. We've got a question about bonds. Bonds, and the point is, it's like people are very afraid right now. They're very concerned. When interest rates are very, very low, it means that the bond market, which is the collective group of people that buy and sell bonds, have concluded that the demand for loans into the future is going to be very, very low compared to historically. And we're not going to have any significant inflation. Matter of fact, they're making a bet we'll have practically no inflation. But the bottom line to it is, if you buy a 10-year U.S. Treasury, you're completely confident that you will get back your money in 10 years, even if it's worth less. So people buy that out of fear.
Hey, Cooper, we're getting lots of emails saying that our audio quality is horrible. Could you lower the volume on the main mic and keep the volume up on our phone? I think that might help things. Because on our end, it sounds great. It's something going on the board at the studio. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Linda. Sorry about sounding horrible. One says we're nearly inaudible, and the other one says that we have a distant vibrating distortion. Maybe it's the aliens.
Could be.
All right, go back to what you were talking about. Sorry about that.
So the yield on the Treasury is very, very low. And it's like Will Rogers said during the Great Depression, people these days are far more concerned about return of their money than return on their money. And I think that's a lot of what's going on around the world. By the way, interestingly enough, in the midst of the trade war and everything else with China, they're continuing to healthily buy U.S. Treasuries. They don't hold a great number of U.S. Treasuries compared with the number one holder. The number one holder of U.S. Treasuries is American citizens and banks and companies. I mean, by far and away, the biggest purchaser of U.S. Treasuries is banks. in the United States. Foreigners hold a significant portion, but not a lot. And the Chinese hold a little piece of that. So this thing about if the Chinese were to sell off all the treasuries, the United, they could collapse the dollar. It just is not credible. First off, if they tried to sell off all the treasuries, everybody else would be buying them up, so it wouldn't have that much of an effect. The second thing is they would run out of credibility themselves because they use dollars to purchase the raw materials that they use in their economy. So it would be kind of like, I'm going to injure you by putting a gun to the side of my head and pulling a trigger. And I don't think they'll do that. Wouldn't make a lot of sense. See, what else? Oil rose 5% to $32.17. That's another thing that has to do with China. Why did oil rise from the market and the treasury yield suggests that the economy may be a little slower in the near future? And the answer is pretty simple. The Chinese economy is recovering very nicely. And they're burning a lot of oil, and they're importing it from us. So the demand for oil from China has risen dramatically, just like the demand for grain, which we'll talk about a little later. And that's the markets.
All right. Well, we've got tons to talk about. You mentioned this in passing, that Chairman Powell and Secretary Mnuchin have, through their different apparently, they're not talking directly to each other. They're talking through media and press. It's quite interesting. But the Treasury Secretary requested that all of the lending programs expire, these special lending programs that were set up in concert with the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury, that are set to expire at the end of the year. But they were set to expire at the end of the year months ago when we didn't know what was going on with the pandemic. And the Federal Reserve would really like those emergency lending programs to stay open just in case. Now, they haven't been used very much. And so from the perspective of the Treasury Secretary, he says, you know, they haven't been used. Why do we have them open? Let's hand them back to Congress and see what they have to do. Here's the thing. The Federal Reserve is requesting that they stay open for flexibility purposes. The Federal Reserve has lowered interest rates as low as they can go. They don't want to go negative. They're buying up mortgage bonds in very, very large numbers. They are more and more hampered on what they could do if we have another situation like what we had in March, where the credit market seized up. They don't have a lot of opportunity to dump a bunch of money back in there, and Congress hasn't passed a stimulus on the fiscal level, another one. So that means that the cash markets could dry up, and the Federal Reserve says that's a pretty low possibility, but we would like to keep these lending programs available for just in case. But the Treasury Secretary says, no, we want them paid back by the end of the year. Give us the money back by the end of the year. We're not going to extend these loaning programs. These loaning programs, just as a side note, are the only act by the federal government that is a direct aid to the ownership of businesses rather than to the employees of business. The Paycheck Protection Program was designed specifically to target payroll, not the ownership, not to preserve the business, to preserve the employment of the people working at the business. These other loans, one of them is called the Main Street Loan. Some of them are corporate-based loans. They have not been used very much. There's very little of the money that was allocated to them that's been used. But the Federal Reserve has been looking at these as a stopgap measure in case something major happened quickly, just in case. Those of you that are listening are not aware of this. Congress has a tendency to act the opposite to quickly. And getting new money back out of Congress in the event of the disaster would require something that hasn't happened since March, and that is that the Democrats and the Republicans let bygones be bygones and vote for the same thing at the same time. So the Federal Reserve, a non-political institution, although it's got politics involved, like everything else. Politics means people in Greek. It is designed to be less based on what's popular at the moment and more designed on the expert analysis of where our currency is headed. When the Treasury Secretary said, no, we're closing these down, it removed some tools from the Federal Reserve's emergency toolbox. I don't think that's a good idea. And I could understand if the vaccine was fully out, if we're seeing a resurgence of business and the infection rate is dropping, saying, hey, we don't need these things anymore. But we're not seeing that. We're seeing the opposite. We're seeing an infection rate that's going up at a rate that it has never gone up before in the United States. We're seeing way above any of the other two bulges that some people might refer to as waves. This may be the third one, and it's way bigger than the other two. You could combine the other two, and it wouldn't be as big as this one. It's getting less headlines because we're all sick of hearing about COVID, and because there's an election that maybe or maybe not is done, or maybe it's over, but maybe it's not. It's being contested, and who's in charge and what's going on. So that's taken up the headlines. But the reality is, if we had started the pandemic with this wave, there'd be a lot more dead people than 252,000. And that's more than a quarter million people. There's just really no way of approaching this but to say, hey, we need those extra tools in the toolbox. Chairman Powell was appointed by this president because this president thought he was the right guy for this job. I have a lot of problem with appointing the best expert you can find and then doubting his opinion every time he talks. That's a problem that I've had for a long time. And I had that problem with other presidents too. I had that problem when George W. Bush was having a tiff with the Fed. I had that problem when Barack Obama was having a tiff with the Fed. And when Bill Clinton, it doesn't matter. You guys are the ones that appointed the guy. You figured he was the best guy for the job. Stop second guessing him. And that is my quick soapbox on. I think the Fed should be given more tools, not less, at this particular moment. And then we take them all back when we're past the crisis. There you go.
Well, it's a little bit in light, particularly the fact that we're having more COVID cases now than we had at the peak in the spring. And we're having hospitalizations in many areas in the country at a higher rate, and businesses are declaring bankruptcy and laying people off. I think it's probably part of the wind down of the administration.
I agree. I mean, this is one of those things that I do not think that the Treasury Secretary would be taking these tools back if he thought that the current president won. I think that this is a long-term negative to the economy to take this away. There's no real good reason to do it. The Treasury Secretary pointed at the fact that they haven't been used very much. But I point at that and say that's a good thing because we're using all of the other tools as much as we can, and we have some spares in here. That's the strategy that the Fed has always used to carefully balance out its tools.
We got another email indicating that our volume is turned up too much, and so we're distorted.
Yeah, and I have checked when you've been talking to our feed on the internet. It is pretty distorted. That's something that happens when the main microphone is still either on, or there's another feed that's feeding back into the phone loop. We've now got lots and lots of email saying we're distorted, and it says that, and I'll turn down our volume into the system, but I don't think that's the issue. I think it's at the board, because when we're listening to it on our board here, this is a virtual cast, by the way. We are in our home studios sending through, and this is the same way we've done it for a little over a month now, and it sounded great. But the K-10 board has been faulty. So, yeah, you want to take back over? I'm going to listen over to the other feed real quick and see if we got anything fixed.
Okay. Let's go on. The economy. Well, the big news in the economy continues to be the elephant in the room, to use a old saw. And the elephant in the room is fairly simple. We have a pandemic going on, and the pandemic is breaking records. It's that simple. There are more new cases per day than we had in the peak early on in the year. Matter of fact, the daily rate rose to 187,000 per day on Thursday, which is another new record. And the rate of death in the United States right now, which was we used to talk about 1,000 people per day dying. Now we've got about 2,000 people per day dying in the United States on the 7-day moving average as of Thursday. We have had more than 252,000 people die in the United States. Now, if you are in an area where the impact of coronavirus is not as big as that, well, then you can be very thankful for that. But a lot of places where the coronavirus didn't hit so hard earlier are seeing their hospitals fill up. Here in Texas, by the way, Texas is leading the United States right now with the number of deaths and the number of new coronavirus cases. Now, here in Central Texas, where we are, it's still relatively minor. We're up to about 212 people dead in Bell County, and the infection rate continues to rise. But the infection rate in Bell County is now rising at about 3% per day. Now, that, as I've said before, that doesn't sound like a lot, but it sure does mount to a lot over a long period of time.
I sure wish we could get a 3% per day return in the market. That sounds like a lot to me.
And it's having an effect on the economy. The data that we normally present is often from the third quarter, which ended a month and a half ago, or from last month, if it's really up to date. But somewhere around the middle of October, the economy stopped. It looks like the economy stopped growing and started slipping backwards. Moody's has a back to normal indicator. It's an index, and they measure a lot of things into it, like the number of miles being driven, the amount of gasoline being used, things that are right up to date, number of what's called footfalls, people going in and out of businesses. And it's gradually slipping backwards. It was rising all during the year, and we've now got it started slowly slipping backwards. It was at 83.4 last month. In other words, we were about 83.4% back to normal. And last week, it dropped 81.6. Now, that doesn't mean the economy is about to collapse. We're actually treating coronavirus a lot better than we treated it before. But at the rate of growth that we're seeing right now, if we don't do something to check it, we'll start to see hospitals overflow. Well, we're already starting to see that in Texas. El Paso area is transferring patients and has been transferring patients to the rest of the state because they simply don't have any more room in the hospital. I know a chaplain who works at a local hospital, and she said their hospital was literally full. They're turning away patients.
Yeah. I'm hearing the same thing from ICU doctors.
So it's a bad time to get sick, and it's a bad time to get coronavirus. Admittedly, only 1% to 2% of the people who get coronavirus wind up in the hospital really, really sick. But if you're part of it, and we actually know some people who've had that happen to them who are not particularly old, they're in the 60s, and they certainly didn't have a lot of what's called comorbidities. They didn't have anything seriously wrong with them. And I know a few people who are younger than that who wound up very, very, very sick for an extended period of time. Admittedly, it's a fairly low percentage, but it's certainly nothing like the flu. The worst we ever had as a flu death rate in the United States was 100,000 people over a 2-year period. So that averaged 50,000 people a year. And we had 1 year where in the calendar year, there was a 60,000 deaths in the United States from influenza. We've had the coronavirus going about 9 months, and we have over 250,000 people dead. That's serious business, folks. And that is affecting the economy. The reason we talk about it on this show is because it's affecting the economy. It has some bright sides, though. And we talked about that in our newsletter.
I was going to say housing starts, home sales, I mean, mortgage rates, all of this is good stuff. Mortgage rates right now, according to Freddie Mac, the mortgage rates for their primary market. So this is a lower rate than most people get. But if you've got about a 700 plus credit score, the average rate right now on a 30-year fixed rate mortgage is 2.7%. That is not just historically low. There's no comparison in history to that low a rate for a mortgage. When we're looking back at the last 40 years and averaging inflation during that time period, it's at 3.6%, which means that's nearly a full point below what inflation has been. If inflation keeps doing what it's doing, it's coming back slowly. Right now, what did you say inflation was?
It's the 1 point something. It's varying between 1.2 and 1.4.
So if you throw inflation in there, and if you have enough deductions that you can deduct your mortgage interest, you're talking about a less than 1% rate on your loan, which is just crazy. That is amazing, and this is why we have the housing starts and the existing home sales up at record levels as well. Housing starts isn't at a record level, but very close to it. It is almost back, and this is according to the economic research for the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, otherwise known as Fred. Yes, that is what economists call the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, Fred.
Or something, but Fred's a good name.
Yeah. So Fred has our housing start index right at 1,530 at the end of October. In January, it was at 1,617. So it has a little bit more to go before it hits the peak that we had in January, but we're higher than we were last November. Last November, housing starts were under 1,400. This November, it's above 1,500. That's not the number. It's an index number. It's not the number of houses, but it means that we've grown, that we're above where we were pre-pandemic, unless you count the very month that it was at the very peak prior to the pandemic starting. What does that mean? It means interest rates are having a big impact on people buying and building homes. This is a big deal. I mean, people are getting the opportunity to build their dream home or buy their dream home in a way that they did not expect to have this opportunity in their planning coming up to now. So there's a silver lining, but the cloud that it's lining is really big and really dark. We do have some silver linings. Now, Handbag, you have some other things to talk about.
Well, there's some good news out there. Not only are existing home sales at the highest level since 2006. Now, why from 2006? What happened in 2006? A lot of people were buying houses in 2006 that they never intended to live in. They were flipping houses. So that's a poor comparison, but that was the highest number of sales we've ever seen was 2006. But we are up there to nearly the same levels we were in the housing bubble, except that people are actually moving into the houses and living there. They're not flipping the houses. I always thought flipping houses would damage them anyway, and it eventually turned out to do that.
I see what you're doing. Flipping houses as a joke.
But not only are we seeing that the price of houses rising 15.5% in the last 12 months, the average house, median house in the United States, for an existing home is $313,000, which is another new record. This is a great time to sell your house. The problem with selling your house is you have to interact with people. And when we see people selling houses, a big piece of the house sale market, as opposed to the house purchase market, is older people who are moving out of their houses and downsizing. And older people are the people that are at greatest risk to be really, really sick from coronavirus, so they're tending to sit in place rather than sell their houses. Let me tell you, if you're going to sell, if you're in a mind to sell your house under whatever circumstances, this is probably about the best you're going to see. Anecdotally, we've heard reports of house prices rising dramatically. By the way, down in Austin, house prices have risen so much that it's affecting the tax rate. Well, not the tax rate. It's affecting the tax payment that people make. And their tax payments are going up as their house price goes up, particularly if they're under 65. And they just can't afford to live there anymore. So it's kind of funny. What we saw is the gentrification of a neighborhood, which forced out the relatively low-income people down there. And we know a case where a guy was earning the low income, but he couldn't, his income wasn't rising as fast as the taxes on his house, so he moved out. So it's being regentrified to even more wealthy people. And that's going on across the country as well. Industrial production was up 1.1% in October. That's a piece of good news. I can go on. You got something?
I'm working, trying to get sound settings done. So I've got a lot of good stuff. We can talk about student loans. Go ahead.
Industrial production in the United States is an indicator of what the whole economy is doing. It's not the perfect indicator, but it's a good one. It's still down almost, 5.6% from February, just before the pandemic hit. But it rose 1.1% in October. Why? And it's a place where we're getting some hiring. People are paying down their credit card debt, but their total debt per household is rising dramatically on the average across the United States. And why is it rising? Because people who lived in apartments are buying houses that are very expensive and they're getting mortgages. So if you buy, and I know this sounds ridiculous, let's say you buy the median house in the United States and you pay $313,000. You paid, let's say, $30,000 of that. You have about $250,000 of extra debt that you didn't have before on your books. So we see the debt rising. People are buying cars, SUVs mainly, and trucks. I say cars, but they're mostly buying light trucks and SUVs. And they're also buying recreational vehicles, I guess, so they can go on vacation and not have to interact with people. But the point is, we have a section of the economy that's doing very well because of the coronavirus. I could go on. Are you done with your fine and sound thing yet?
I need to test it. If you can talk just a little bit more, I will come back to you.
Well, there's something else. We had China's economy is recovering very nicely. And a lot of it is to do with the fact that we're importing a lot of things from China. But what's happening also is there's a critical shortage of hog food, which is the kind of wheat that's grown across the Midwest, particularly in the wintertime. And so farmers who were very, very afraid of what was going to happen because of the coronavirus, why were they afraid? They were afraid because a lot of corn is grown across the Midwest that goes into ethanol, that goes into gasoline. And gasoline usage is down pretty dramatically because of the coronavirus. But the farmers, if they're smart, also had something besides corn. They had wheat growing. And it turns out that the wheat is in high, high demand for pig food. Why is it in demand for pig food? Because there was an epidemic of African swine fever in China. By the way, Roger just said that we're much better now.
Oh, that's good. Hopefully that was something happening that we did, huh? It may have been random, though.
This is a global economy, and right now, the fact that there was a virus that hit the pigs in China that caused the majority of hogs in China to be slaughtered and burned, it's called culled, if you want to be polite about it. Now that they've got that behind them and they've got it contained and under control, the pig farmers in China are having to grow a lot more pigs. Why? Because the economy in China is recovering, and when the economy recovers in China, people eat more pork. They eat a lot more pork. And if you've ever been to a Chinese restaurant, you see the quantity of pork that gets served in the various dishes. You see that they really prefer pork. And it's certainly true in China from people who've been there and have talked to me about it.
And this is something
We talked about this last week, that there's a big spike in demand for beef products from the United States to China because they're so short on pork. And it may be that this will be that transition point that we see regularly throughout history where an economy shifts from pork to beef. But for right now, they haven't fully made that shift. So there's a massive demand for pork. Did you cover already? I may have missed this. We had a question in there about the empty shipping containers going back to China when we're shipping back so much grain. What's going on with that?
I didn't get to that.
Okay. The answer to that is you don't generally ship grain in shipping containers. So this. It's an easy way to say, hey, what's going on here? But the reality is that you ship grain in a big cargo ship that's not in shipping containers. It's in a big, it's almost like a granary ship. Unless you're putting them in bags, which is a much less efficient way of transporting large amounts of grain. And we're buying more from China than we're selling to China, which means that we will be sending back empty cargo containers until that reverses. That's just a simple statement of our balance of trade with China is very, very much on the we buy from them and they sell to us rather than the other way around. We do sell some things to them, but the things that we sell to them generally don't go in shipping containers. Sometimes they do. But that just leaves us with a lot of empty shipping containers going back to China. Did you hit the term premium question that we had?
Talked about term premium.
Okay, good.
The thing I wanted to bring up here is a virus that hits hogs in China is beneficial to farmers in the Midwest. That's a global economy. We have become, because China does not grow a lot of soft red wheat. Because they don't grow the soft wheat, they can't make their own hog food. Now, usually Brazil and Russia supply a tremendous amount of grain for food. And another interesting little tidbit here, this is one of those little things that I think is fascinating. Brazil is the largest soybean exporter in the world. The United States is number two.
Mm-hmm.
Brazil is now importing soybeans from the United States. It was a ship full of soybeans that actually sailed completely full of soybeans, bulk dry carrier, sailed to Brazil to offload because Brazil is buying soybeans from the United States. And the reason Brazil is buying soybeans from the United States, you don't think this is crazy, is because there's high inflation in Brazil. Did you get that?
High inflation in Brazil causes them to buy soybeans when they're the number one producer of soybeans in the world.
And what's happening is, farmers across Brazil are storing their soybeans in their fields in plastic containers because the soybean price keeps going up and the price of their currency keeps going down. And so the soybeans make for great investments in Brazil just by holding the soybeans. So they stopped actually selling their soybeans. They grow them and they store them in what are called these horizontal silos that they lay out on the ground. And so there's a shortage of soybeans in Brazil, the largest producer and exporter of soybeans in the world. So because of high inflation in Brazil, farmers in the United States are seeing an increase in the price of soybeans.
That is global.
That's the way the economy works. The other thing that's going on, and it has to do with this container question, we need to do commercials.
Yeah, we do. Let's play some commercials before we go any farther. We may not even have enough time for it. We'll have more to talk about next hour. We certainly haven't run out of things to talk about. If you'd like to email us, we've got email addresses at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That is Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. And we'll be back on the other side of these commercials with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and Jeff McClure. We only have about 1.5 minutes left this hour. We'll be back next hour with more. Hopefully the distortions are gone from our voices.
We can talk about containers.
Yes, we can talk about containers. We can talk about student loans. We can talk about all kinds of good stuff.
Yeah, I want to talk about why we have a record import. Our balance of trade is all out of whack at present, but how it's a good thing.
Yeah, I think I agree with you on that. So that there's a lot to talk about. Well, this has been a busy week. But if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually do give personalized fiduciary investment advice based on your situation, customized to you, in your best interest, for people of high net worth. If you would like to call our voicemail and talk off the air during the weekend, or there's real life people to answer during the week, there's a local number available at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same line at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got newsletters on there that have a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that go into those things. We've got recordings of the radio program going back lots of years and a contact form. You can also email us directly.